This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Journalist and essayist Hal Crowther has a fascination with getting people's stories right, especially after they've passed away. He calls himself a self-appointed reputation adjuster. Hal's latest collection of essays is an effort to do just that. It is called Freedom Fighters and Hellraisers, a gallery of memorable Southerners. And in it, he tells the stories of prominent departed Southerners, people like journalist Molly Ivins, conservative firebrand Jesse Helms, and historian John Hope Franklin. Hal Crowther's award-winning writing has been featured in Newsweek, Time, Oxford American, and much, much more. And he joins us in our studios now. Welcome back, Hal.
Hey, great to be back, Frank.
It's always a pleasure to have you, and I want to get into the fascinating people, some of whom I'm embarrassed to say I didn't know about until I read your book.
That's part of the point. I'm just really trying to be a posthumous publicist for some of these individuals that I admired.
Well, talk more about that. Let's just talk about the concept here, because you write about in your introduction the notion of obituary, the way in which we memorialize the dead, and the way in which the dead have no right to come back, when they're talked about after they're gone. Tell us more about that.
Well, I was actually shocked to find that anyone who dies has given up, his sort of right to his own legacy and his own story. And it doesn't matter what your heirs, your family might object to or lawsuits, et cetera. It won't do any good. Dead people can't sue. And I realized in a couple of instances that terrible things had been done to people that I admired. I think I used, the example of Lillian Gish, the famous actress that I know this makes me sound as if I'm 100 years old. It's true. I interviewed Lillian Gish, who was born in 1892. And I think that,
good one, Hal.
And of course, UB Blake is also in this book, and he was born in 1883, and I did interview both of them. But it was almost shocking to me to think that a person's reputation could be torn to shreds by this one enemy they didn't know they had, the moment that they were cold. And I don't know, I have this sort of righteousness, and I started writing these pieces quite a while ago.
And actually, this fascination began, according to the introduction, with the passing of your great-grandmother, right?
My great-grandmother was born in England in 1862, and she lived to be 94. And I knew her, of course, until I was, 12 or 13 years old. And she used to tell me stories about Queen Victoria and so on, and fascinating stuff about, long before electricity or cars or planes and so on. And she was an incredibly valuable source, right? And no one talked to her. I mean, she'd been a widow for 40 years, and she was upstairs in a big house in upstate New York all alone. And what she had to say was fascinating, and I was harvesting it at 11, 12 years old, and no one else was paying attention. And after she died, I just thought, people need to tell those stories if they have those stories.
Well, one of the stories that you document is the story of Molly Ivins, Freedom Fighters and Hellraisers, and she's a little bit of both, I guess, huh?
That also, that phrase was chosen from her work. That was one of her quotes. All my friends are freedom fighters and hellraisers. Molly certainly was. It was unusual, I guess, that she was in college in New England the same time I was, same class, same age. And I did encounter her when we were both 18 years old, and then we were in the same class at Columbia Journalism. So I had known her off and on. I saw her when she was working for the New York Times in New York. And I kind of watched that very unusual personality through the years. And, of course, when she got to, her full nationally well-known persona, this sort of lady from Texas who will say anything to anyone. And she had that lovely style. I mean, I wrote a book about, I think I was on your show with my book about H.L. Mencken. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there's ever been a woman with a style like Mencken's that was so incendiary, so absolutely unbuttoned and over the top. And there's just been no one like her since.
It's amazing because you talk about her education in the Northeast, working for the New York Times, but she never lost her Texas. And we've got a clip here where she's talking to David Letterman on the Tonight Show.
Let's talk about the title of the book here. Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She? What is that referring to?
Oh, when I first started writing my political column, I felt impelled to describe the performance of a local congressman by saying, if his IQ slips any lower, we'll have to water him twice a day.
Right.
It upset a lot of his supporters, and they canceled their subscriptions and threatened to start boycotts. And so my paper took out billboards all around Dallas, Texas, that said, "Molly Ivins can't say that, can she?"
And are you beloved by the folks who read the paper, or is it split right down the middle? Some hate you, some love you. How does that go?
They do polls every year that to find out who's the best liked and most hated columnist in the area. I'm always both.
Molly Ivins on Late Night with David Letterman. In 1991, one of the people profiled in Hal Crowther's new book, Freedom Fighters and Hellraisers, a gallery of memorable Southerners. I had the great pleasure of working with Molly Ivins in 1984 for the Republican National Convention in Dallas. We'd hired her to do commentary. And it struck me in reading your book and some of the thoughts that you've had around journalism and the way we talk about people. I'm not sure we'd hired that. I mean, that's not the kind that her voice was amazing, an incredible voice, so direct. It's not who I hear on television and radio as much anymore. She was really iconic and also, in many cases, a time capsule, sadly.
Well, out of serious journalism, in my opinion, we have taken a lot of the really colorful characters and the gifted originals. As you know, most newspapers no longer employ columnists. Yeah. And Molly had that special voice, and I don't think she's been replaced by anyone at all. And the only people who do have what you would call an extremely colorful, confrontational style are these people who are not journalists at all. And as a matter of fact, Sean Hannity has said many times, "No, I am not a journalist."
Yeah.
They're partisan propagandists,
right.
And they sort of do this thing to stir up the faithful. But people like Molly and Mike Royko, yeah, who had that style all the time, whatever their subject was, and they weren't, you know, boosting any group or party. That was coming right out of the heart of who they were.
Yeah. It's a lost art. Well, let's talk about, move on and talk about John Hope Franklin, another figure you write about, in all of his nuance and complexity.
Well, this is a man that I met when he was already pretty advanced in years, and I don't know, it's, to go back to Molly, too, I guess it says something about my personality that if people, you know, in some ways are more difficult to reach, to sort of ingratiate myself with, I will try harder.
Mm-hmm.
And he had encountered some of the things that I had written. And it was, I happened to often dine in the same restaurant in Durham where Dr. Franklin would dine. And I made it a real point to get a chance to talk to him as often as I could. And sure enough, you know, he had a little bit of an edge to begin with, a protective edge. Mm. And once it eroded, he had the most charming, witty, open way of talking. And of course, but also in his work, you know, he was in some ways very harsh about what, you know, the state of race in America and what's gone on in civil rights and so on. And I think that, you know, he had to sort of develop a certain amount of trust, particularly with a person, a white person, in order to tell you what he actually thought. And once he did, not only would he share these things with you, but he'd do it in a way that was very convincing. And
well, this is the challenge, too, if we're talking about, and these are not obituaries in that sense, but reflections on lives. But what happens, I think, when we try to recollect a life, we tend to sort of lean to one side or another. He's either a harsh critic of racial imbalance in the United States of America, the man who forged, basically, I mean, black studies programs. He creates them, and having grown up in a segregated South and a very difficult childhood, having encountered all of that, you might want to side with all that. And that's the problem in trying to write about a life when it's all gone. We don't really, maybe we don't have the space to include the nuance of a fully formed human being.
I think the first thing that I tried hard to do is do justice to everyone here, including a couple of the people that I didn't approve of, like Senator Helms. But, you know, the other thing is that almost all of these essays touch on what I consider to be a very serious issue. Out of the 19 profiles in this book, 8 of them touch on race and civil rights in the South. People, you know, who covered that as journalists or wrote about it as scholars and so on are people who suffered from it. That's almost half the essays in this book. And there's a couple others that touch on the environment, on war, and so on. So these are emphatically not celebrity profiles, mm-hmm. although there are some famous people in this book.
Well, let's talk about one more famous person, or infamous, we should say, Jesse Helms. And in that, I think you sort of take on the way in which his legacy, everybody felt they had to be somehow balanced when he died. He's a segregationist, and he caused a great deal of harm and damage. And you address that directly.
I can say that I often say that I only two people in this book that I never met, and one of them was George Wallace. But my meeting with Jesse Helms was very brief and very, I think, amusing. We were both trying on clothing at Nowell's Men's Store at Cameron Village in Raleigh, and Senator Helms and I are both tall men. And we looked over the top of the booths where we were trying. I was trying on a sport coat, and he was trying on trousers, so I had the advantage over him. And suddenly our eyes met over the top of that divider, and I said with a big happy smile, "Good morning, Senator." And he wouldn't have known my face, but he knew my name. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, from the very beginning when I first moved to North Carolina, what was it, 1980, I think. I've been here a long time. I began to harass him as often and as much as I could. I had never encountered anyone who was an unapologetic segregationist. He was almost too easy a target for me.
Yeah, but after he had passed, people talked about how good he was with his constituents and, you know, this other, which is all true, and you can say it, but ultimately the legacy is segregation, the dehumanization of part of our population, and not really much in the way of apology. That becomes, and to talk about South Africa as well, I mean, you know, being on the wrong side of history, that's your legacy. Live with it and die with it.
He's in the news right now because this FAR that they've just nominated for the federal judgeship was working for Jesse Helms back when he mailed all these postcards, or his people mailed these postcards to black people all over North Carolina telling them that they weren't eligible to vote. So it's back. You know, he never apologized.
Right.
We do have to remember George Wallace, who's also in this book. He not only apologized, but he won 92% of the black vote the last time he was elected governor of Alabama.
George Wallace, yeah.
George Wallace did. And as far as I know, our Senator Helms, who, as you said, not only supported the apartheid government of South Africa, but also the anti-communist supposed death squads in Central America, right, never apologized.
Let's move on to a figure who I am ashamed to say I did not know, Father Thomas Berry, until I read your book.
Father Thomas Berry was a priest who grew up in Greensboro and who was spent a good part of his life in various missions in other parts of the world, who became probably, in my mind, the great prophet of the environment of the last half of the 20th century. His book, A Dream of the Earth, is something that everybody should read. It's this lyrical explanation of basically, and the fact that the Catholic Church couldn't quite swallow this, he said that God is the earth, is creation, is all of us. It's not that God made it or God is presiding over it, but it is God. And everything that you do to harm the earth, to harm the environment and that we live in, harms God, and you are basically committing sacrilege if your whole life is not devoted to what he would think of as, you know, environmental dedication.
And it was more than just sort of recycle and cut down fewer trees. I mean, he took aim at the root cause of all of our environmental damage, which is corporate capitalism that has a very different view of the world and commodifies life itself, and in his mind, tried to commodify God itself. And as you say, the church wasn't having much of that, although it didn't throw him out.
They never threw him out, and they never actually censored him. Yeah. They never refused to, never tried to keep him out of print, but they offered him no encouragement.
Well, talk about his reputation, because as you write in your book, he had a better reputation abroad than he did here.
I encountered people people who were in the Green parties in Europe, who considered him a major figure, an icon. And so in North Carolina, I pointed out he never won a prize from the governor, and I think only one college, I should give credit to the right college, I think it was Elon, ever gave him, is that correct?
According to your book.
Yes, it must be true, ever actually gave him an honorary degree. And he died in his 90s, so he was I think really overlooked, and that's a great thing to be able to do in a book like this, is to call attention to somebody who didn't receive his due.
How did you find out about him?
Well, as a matter of fact, I'm very committed. There's only two issues I think in which I consider myself a radical. One is war. I'm pretty much a full-fledged pacifist. And the other one is the environment. And I've been in touch over the years with a lot of people in the Green Movement, the Shoemaker Society. And he was pointed out to me by a man named Kirkpatrick Sale, who wrote the Conquest of Paradise, about the destruction of the Americas by Columbus and subsequent explorers. He pointed out Father Barry and his work to me, I think, back in the 80s. And I think I read, everything that he published from that time on.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Hal Crowther, award-winning journalist and essayist. The new book is called Freedom Fighters and Hellraisers, A Gallery of Memorable Southerners. Hal, thanks so much. Always good to see you.
Great to be here, Frank. Thanks.
Hal Crowther is going to be reading from the book Saturday, December 1st at 11 o'clock, McIntyre's Books in Pittsburgh. And you can find links to upcoming events at our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up next time on Movies on the Radio, we want to know which film about musicians resonates with you. How about the new Headbanging Queen biopic, or maybe the Oscar-winning film Ray? Films about musicians. Email your picks at sot@wnc.org or tweet us using hashtag SOTMovie. That's the state of things for today. It is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley's our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.